This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Hacking your home. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
With more and more of our homes controlled with a smartphone, the risk of attracting a cyber intruder is growing. Hear how best to protect your smart home.
As the World Cup comes to a close in Russia, a look at the art of diving and flopping by Brazilian soccer star Neymar.
A house divided. A father and son living in the same home are running for the same state legislative seat in Rhode Island.
And the secret club in our nation's capital from where members are said to be running the country.
So Washington, D.C. is one of these cities where there really aren't many secrets. You know, even the closed-door intelligence briefings, people leak what happened. But I found out about this club called the Chowder and Marching Club, which is an entirely confidential group.
Wall Street Journal reporter Janet Hook on a secret D.C. club. She's here in about 25 minutes. Political divide in the country is creating a new landscape for business in which fierce debates often lead consumers and employees to demand that corporations and chief executives take positions on big issues. That is increasingly pulling Walmart, the world's largest retailer and largest private employer, into weighing in on issues such as immigration, the Confederate flag, gun rights, and gay rights, generally after other companies or politicians have done the same. It's a story by Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Nassauer. Sarah, what's happening here?
Walmart is navigating this new corporate environment where employees of companies, you know, consumers, people in general, expect companies and CEOs to have opinions on things that they didn't really expect them to have opinions on in the past. Social issues, political issues, you know, immigration, things that aren't directly necessarily related to businesses. And Walmart, which is, you know, one of the largest companies in the world, this was not really something they did very much in the past, to speak up when they didn't have to. But increasingly they are, and it's been an interesting thing to see sort of how they go about doing that.
Wow. I guess I'm probably dating myself, and I'll ask, where does this come from where we expect companies to have opinions?
You know, when I talked to experts and academics and executive coaches when I was working on this story, it's a little bit squishy why this is happening. Some of it is just our ability to sort of always talk to each other through social media, or have the impression that sort of the microphone is always on. And if a company's not saying something, that means that, you know, there's something wrong and they should be saying something. Some of it seems to be about political polarization and the fact that a lot of people have the impression that the government isn't very good at getting things done. Okay. And so they look to, you know, companies to fill that role. And you see that, for example, when Walmart followed Dick's Sporting Goods and raising the gun buying age to 21 in the wake of the Parkland, Florida shootings. That was an example where, you know, a company was going above and beyond federal law, right, and sort of taking matters into their own hands. And increasingly people sort of look to companies, and activists look to companies to do that kind of thing.
The point that was made about that in the story I thought was interesting, didn't the Walmart CEO say something along the lines of we're fast followers of things like that? That was
Walmart is really, they are not leading the charge on most of the things. And when we, the CEO has said in the past that they don't really want to lead on most things. And that, you know, if it sort of was up to him, they wouldn't be speaking out on political issues. That's not sort of personally what he wants to be doing. However, you know, he also said when he made those comments, you know, people expect things of leading companies, and sometimes we need to take a stance on things. He was speaking specifically several years ago about a tweet. He had sent out a tweet about, or the company had sent out a tweet about opposing the Arkansas Religious Freedom Bill that was going through the state at the time, and that critics thought was going to limit gay rights. And so he was coming out against that and giving an explanation as to why.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Nassauer. Her piece is called "Walmart Takes a Stand on Guns and Gay Rights to Get People to Like It More." Somebody may represent the story that Walmart tends to take liberal positions on social issues.
They're starting to be, the positions that they're taking publicly are more liberal than they have been in the past. I would say they are pretty careful in how they word their positions to give a nod to kind of all sides and all ways of thinking generally. Okay. Again, they're not trying to lead here on very many things.
I guess I'm hung up to a certain extent on the fast follower comment, in that I thought Walmart was a leader, you know, at least at one time when it comes to retail thinking and stuff. And it just strikes me like, well, we're a fast follower, so when it comes to an issue, we'll just call Dick's and Target and see what they're up to, and then we'll tag along.
I don't think they call Dick's or Target, but they do, we talk about in the story sort of their thought process ahead of making that decision to raise the gun buy age to 21. So basically, you know, there was the Parkland shooting, and then about a week later, President Donald Trump, as well as Florida Republicans, started to publicly voice support for raising the federal gun buying age, or in Florida's case, the state gun buying age, to 21. Right now it's 18 on the federal level, except for handguns. It's 21 for handguns. And then internally at Walmart, you know, they continued talking about, well, how should we be selling guns? And that sort of got them internally considering that idea. And then Dick's Sporting Goods came out about a week after that, in the morning, really with an emotional statement on Good Morning America from the CEO about why they were doing it and why they believed in it. And by that evening, Walmart had made a less emotional, but, you know, linking it to the shooting type of announcement that they were doing the same.
Thanks, Sarah. Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Nassauer. And our business update has been brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. 13 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. On the biggest stage in sports, at the World Cup, some of the best talents on the planet reveal themselves to be D-list actors. They pantomime pain. They exaggerate like silent film stars. They don't seem to care who sees. They sometimes react as if they've been shot when they've barely made physical contact, if any, with an opponent. The bad acting has acting instructors cringing while watching some of these games, especially the games that involved Brazil and their scoring star, Neymar. It's a story by Andrew Kay, European sports correspondent at the New York Times. He's with us from Samara, Russia, where he's covering the World Cup. Andrew, what have you put together?
We wanted to write a story kind of about diving and simulation and play acting, which really pops up every 4 years at the World Cup. It's not something new. So we wanted to kind of get a different way into the subject. So kind of based off the premise that, you know, this is not some sort of new problem. It's not an isolated problem. It's something that all players seem to do on some level. We said, you know, why don't we have some fun with it and sort of ask, you know, who's actually good at it, who's bad at it. And we thought, who better to ask than, you know, people whose job it is to train people. So we reached out to a few acting coaches to get their opinion on it and had some fun with it.
So what are they saying? What are these acting instructors and experts saying about what soccer players do, say, when they flop and are looking to have a foul called?
Well, they were all pretty critical, as you might expect. Soccer players aren't highly trained actors by in any sense. One thing that kind of was a common theme running through all the comments I got was that we have kind of this impulse when we're trying to convince somebody of something to overplay it, to overact, to exaggerate. You feel like you need to convince them, so you do something extra. But what all that ends up doing is sort of alienating your viewer from you, kind of making them suspicious. And, you know, that in turn kind of engenders some of the bad feelings you see. People watch some of these players hit the ground.
Somebody made an interesting point that, and it may have been a soccer person, who just saying a good number of soccer players do this, but Neymar from Brazil just happens to be the worst of them.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with that. If you watch this World Cup, any of the games closely, you'll see it. And it's not just flopping. I mean, it's time wasting, you know, getting angry at the referee, or, you know, pretending, you know, when you've been called for a foul, sort of pretending like, you know, you're totally ignorant of it. Like, what, I did something. So there are all these little things that happen in soccer. I mean, I think it sort of adds to the richness of the game. I happen to sort of like the dramatic side of it. So, you know, I thought that was a valid point he made. And when it comes to Neymar, I guess the reason he gets so much attention is that he's so sort of operatic. You see so much pain and anguish in his face. He's waving his arms around. So all the attention sort of gets heaped on him. So he gets sort of the brunt of the criticism. But I mean, I think it's fair to say that, you know, every team and, you know, around this World Cup has a large number of people that are looking for the edge any way they can doing these sorts of tricks.
Right. We're speaking with New York Times European sports correspondent Andrew Kay. He's with us from Samara, Russia, talking about a piece he's written about the Brazilian star Neymar, and it's called Neymar and the Art of the Dive. Although, to be fair, somebody in your story said pro athletes can make good actors at times.
Yeah, I spoke to an interesting guy. He's the on-set acting coach for CSI Los Angeles. And he spent a good part of the 90s working with an NBA player you might have heard of named Rick Fox, mm-hmm. who over the course of a long career with the Celtics and Lakers actually found the time to do a good bit of acting in different movies and on TV. And he was saying, you know, there was something about him that was just kind of natural. And you know, when you have these guys, athletes who are very aware of their bodies, can sort of control themselves that way, you know, they can be suited to it. I don't know how much evidence there is of that, but he seems sort of convinced.
Well, the internet has had a field day on Neymar, haven't they? I mean, just the stuff cracks me up. I know you included some of it in your story. Do you think that ever winds its way back to him and he might dial this back? Or is this is just who he is?
That's a great question. I mean, this is something that's a label that's kind of stuck with him for years and years and years. This is not something new with Neymar either. We spoke to Ronaldo, the Brazilian Ronaldo, not the Portuguese Ronaldo, who made an interesting point, sort of that, you know, there's nobody that gets fouled as much as Neymar. There's nobody that gets kicked as much as Neymar. He's a guy that dribbles around a lot, and people are always trying to take him out.
Thanks, Andrew. Andrew Kay, European sports correspondent at the New York Times. 22 minutes now after the hour. On this weekend, Hank Ledger with us. In the modern home, everything from TVs and refrigerators to baby monitors and light bulbs can now be connected and hacked. The number of smart homes in North America is expected to be more than 50% by the year 2021. It used to be clear when a break-in had occurred, right? Maybe a window was smashed, a door forced open. But today, technology is making privacy invasion more insidious. Here's how to better protect yourself in your home from MarketWatch reporter Carrie Paul. Carrie, help us out.
So I wrote the story a little bit back, and then we decided to republish it today in light of the Sonos connected speaker offering announced today. So as these connected devices get more and more prominent, it's just something that you need to keep in mind of potentially being hacked.
So in these current homes, these smart homes, what can hackers do if and when they get in?
Right. So there was a recent case of a security vulnerability with connected doorbells that allowed people to be looking at your camera outside your house. And it actually came to light when a couple that had broken up, the former partner texted his ex and said, "Hey, why aren't you walking the dog more often?" And when he asked how he knew that, he said, "Oh, well, I still have access to our doorbell."
Wow.
So just things like that obviously are just creepy. It doesn't necessarily mean that your bank account's going to be drained or something like that, but it's a different level of hacking where it comes down to personal privacy.
Yeah. I mean, in extreme cases, you could unlock somebody's front door in theory, right?
Right, exactly. And it's not just your computer or your phone that's being hacked. It's your home. It's where you live. So it's an extra level of security that you need to be aware of.
Wow. All right. So what do we do to better protect ourselves?
Everyone should definitely be using two-factor authentication on different devices. That means you get a text to your cell phone or an email or a phone call that just gives you a code that tells you, that basically verifies that you're the person who's trying to log in. So just that extra layer of security can do a lot for you in the case of someone that is hacking.
Does everything we, I guess, have as a possession electronically offer the two-factor authentication?
Not everything, but there is a website called twofactorauth.org where you can search different websites and products, and it'll tell you what has that.
Oh, how about that? Very good.
Yeah, but most major platforms should. Like, I have it on my Instagram, I have it on my Facebook, and my Gmail, and my Twitter. So anything that I use often, and it's just a text that comes in, it makes it a little less seamless to log on, but it can be great for your security.
Wow, very good. What else do you recommend?
You should definitely be changing the default passwords on new devices that you get. Something that a lot of people don't realize is that when you get a Wi-Fi router from your internet company, the little code on the back, you know, when you're visiting a friend's house and you ask for the Wi-Fi password and they give you a really long, annoying string of numbers, that shouldn't be happening. You should be changing those passwords because hackers can easily look up what the common default passwords are for these. And then once they get into your router, they can get into anything connected to it in your house. So that's a really important baseline thing that you can be doing to make your apartment or home more secure.
Well, we're speaking with MarketWatch personal finance reporter Carrie Paul. She's written a piece about ways to keep your smart home from being hacked. And you said, too, don't use public Wi-Fi. Explain that connection.
Right. So if you're using public Wi-Fi, hackers can more easily access your device. And that's something that sometimes your device will do automatically. So make sure you go into your iPhone or whatever phone you have on the settings and turn off the automatically connect setting, because otherwise you could be joining in different hotspots when you're around. If you can buy a wireless hotspot like a Verizon Jetpack or use your own phone as a hotspot if you want to connect your laptop to something that's secure. So if you're in an airport, I would recommend never using that public Wi-Fi.
There you go. Thanks, Carrie. That's MarketWatch reporter Carrie Paul. 30 minutes now after the hour. On This Weekend, when a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, there really is a secret political club in Washington. Also, some people don't know what the P means in IHOP, let alone the I, well, the H, and the O. And the father and son running for the same legislative seat in Rhode Island. Well, in a self-important, gossipy town like Washington, D.C., where almost no conversation is safe from leaks, there is one bastion of secrecy on Capitol Hill. The Chowder and Marching Club is kept so far under wraps that members are reluctant to even acknowledge its existence. But Wall Street Journal reporter Janet Hook got the scoop on it. Janet, what'd you find?
So Washington, D.C. is one of these cities where there really aren't many secrets. You know, even the closed-door intelligence briefings, people leak what happened. Sometimes people live-tweet closed-door meetings. But I and my colleague who covers Congress, Natalie Andrews, found out about this club called the Chowder and Marching Club, which is an entirely confidential group. I had heard about it a long time ago. So the first rule of the Chowder and Marching Club is that members don't talk about it. Non-members. So it posed a real reporting challenge for us. What we found out is it's a club made up entirely of House Republicans in Congress and former House Republicans. And they meet once a week when the House is in session. And the meeting is just dinner, drinks, and chat. They talk about politics and policy, but they're not supposed to, at least, talk about it outside the room.
Yet somebody did to you.
Right. So I kind of bumped into one member in the Capitol who was a former member of Congress, and I said, oh, what are you doing here? And he said, oh, I'm going to the Chowder and Marching meeting. And I said, oh, what's that? And so that was my first way in.
Wow.
And then when we started doing research on it, Natalie found on Twitter that 4 years ago, one of the members actually posted a picture of herself going to the Chowder and Marching banquet. And when they go, they have this banquet every few years, and they wear chef's hats and aprons. And so there's this goofy picture of Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, a Republican from Florida, on Twitter. So when we confronted her with this, she said, oh, Yeah, they probably choked me after that appeared.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal national political reporter Janet Hook about the exclusive and secret Chowder and Marching Club in Washington. The headline, which may be misleading, I guess, it says the members run America. I mean, how accurate is that?
Yes, that was a little tongue-in-cheek, a little hyperbolic, I would say.
Okay.
It is true that the members of the club, though, tend to be people who either are or move on to power positions of great power and influence. The club started in the late 40s, and its early members, its founding members, included Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, who were, at the time, House members, what went on to be president, vice president of the United States. And when the club picks new members, the way it works is, you know, there's a couple dozen members, and every year or every time a new class of House Republicans is elected, they kind of scour them and see who looks like they might be an up-and-coming member. They tend to be more kind of institutionalists, not kind of bomb throwers. So there is this sense that in that room, it includes Kevin McCarthy, the House Majority Leader, and the Speaker of the House, that in that room is a really serious slice of the Washington establishment.
How about that? Wow. So do you pay to belong, or you're just sort of invited, and then what, you might be asked to pick up dinner one night? How does it work?
Right. There's no dues. You just get invited, and they take turns providing the dinner and drinks for their weekly meetings. So that's the only cost.
Thanks, Janet. Wall Street Journal reporter Janet Hook, who's based in Washington. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend some time with us. Another disappointing survey about credit fraud. New research by Capital One finds a growing number of us have experienced financial theft or fraud. We're joined now by Sarah Strauss, head of fraud at Capital One. Sarah, give us some findings.
Well, we recently conducted a survey of 1,000 people, and what we learned is that more than half of our respondents had experienced some sort of financial theft or fraud, and only 23% of people feel confident in the safety and security of their personal information online. So it's a really big topic. People are thinking about it. They're concerned about it, and it's something we're excited at Capital One to help people address.
You know, your 23% number is interesting, that low number of people feeling confident about their personal information online, yet, geez, I mean, the younger generation just seems to hand it out like candy, that personal info, right?
Yes, it seems that they do. You know, I think there's great benefits from it, as we've seen through social networking sites and things. But I do, you know, we want people to be empowered to be in control of their information, to understand where it is, and to be able to protect themselves from potential fraud. So I think it's important to educate people around, you know, what is information you should be sharing versus what isn't, and then how do you set yourself up for success to monitor that information so that you're not a victim of theft or fraud.
What's the biggest thing that trips up most of us?
I think it's just, one, being able and willing to kind of get the tools to access the information, to know, to be able to protect yourself. I think people are a little bit intimidated, oh, this is going to be hard or complicated, but in reality, it's not. With a tool like CreditWise or Capital One, you can just download the app, enroll, and, you know, it will send you notifications if there are changes or issues in your credit report. And so I think people just need to kind of get over the hurdle of it's not hard to kind of set yourself up for success, to monitor your credit and sort of be in a position to be able to detect fraud. But people are a little bit nervous about sort of taking that first leap.
Yeah. I know your reference here, too, that there's a good number of Americans, almost half, who have heard of the dark web but don't know anything about it. Somebody asked me that the other day, and it's just kind of difficult to explain, but how do you explain what the dark web is?
That is a good question. So, you know, it's essentially, you know, a different part of the internet out there where there are sometimes nefarious activities taking place, and there's a lot of personal information out on the dark web where they're for sale or for, you know, people can access. And so it becomes really important for people to be able to monitor their own personal information with a tool like CreditWise, that they can say, hey, is my SSN out there on the dark web? Is my email out there on the dark web? Or know if their credit or their credit card number has been compromised.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Sarah Strauss. She's the head of fraud at Capital One. We're talking about new numbers for credit fraud. Must be some sort of business component to this for you as well in terms of protection, right? I mean, how much money does the credit card industry lose each year to fraud?
Too much. But, you know, for us, it really comes down to helping consumers protect themselves and take control of their personal information. There's obviously benefits for us in that, and we have less fraud. but I think also just having our customers and other consumers feel empowered to understand their credit, protect their credit, and know if something has been compromised. And so that's why for us it's important to have a tool like CreditWise that really enables people to do that and gives them that control.
And it's free for everybody?
It is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not.
And then do you offer some sort of a tiered service in there for additional protection or stuff?
We do not. It's just flat free for everyone, and everyone has access to the same services. And we have recently released, or we're really excited about, three new features to help consumers protect their credit. One is a Social Security number tracker. So we talked about this earlier, you know, empowering our users to be able to know if their Social Security number has been used, whether it's the dark web or elsewhere. We have credit alerts from Experian and TransUnion that will tell you whether there's meaningful changes on your credit report. And then dark web surveillance, so out there looking around on the dark web for your email or your Social Security number to be able to tell you if you've been compromised and how you can go take action if you have.
Thanks, Sarah. Sarah Strauss, head of fraud at Capital One. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Don't forget, you can follow us on social media. You can friend us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter with the username at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username at Gordon Deal. Well, it turns out the IHOP marketing campaign to change its name to IHOB with a B to promote burgers was just a publicity stunt. But it's revealed a lot about what consumers know about the restaurant. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
You've no doubt heard about IHOP changing its name temporarily to IHOB last month to promote its burgers. This week, the chain reverted back to its longstanding name to draw diners' attention back to its core pancake business. Here with the story, Julie Jargon of the Wall Street Journal. Julie, you interviewed a lot of people who didn't know what the P was for, let alone the B. What did they think P was for?
Well, most people thought it probably had to do with pancakes, but one man thought that IHOP meant hopping out of bed. And a lot of people just didn't realize what all of the letters in IHOP stood for. It stands for International House of Pancakes. But the company had shortened its name to that acronym back in 1973. And so a lot of people just didn't even realize exactly what the letters stood for. One man I talked to didn't even realize it was an acronym at all. He said he had never really thought twice about it.
Julie, when talking to these people, what kind of very general sense did you get of people's impressions of the restaurant itself?
It seemed like most people really view it as a breakfast place, which obviously it has been known as for many, many years. And the idea that they're going to be serving burgers, which they actually already have on the menu, but they're swapping those out for some new and improved burgers. But people really didn't think of IHOP as a place to have hamburgers or to eat lunch or dinner. And so I think a lot of people were a little bit confused by the whole thing. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether this effort to draw a bigger lunch crowd will actually work.
We're speaking with Julie Jargon of the Wall Street Journal. Just in general, I think that most people do go there for a pancake, so this is the big question, whether people will eat burgers. But during the afternoon and evening, don't they still eat pancakes at IHOP?
They still eat pancakes, yeah. That is their predominant business. And, but most of their business does come in the morning, I think more than 50%. And so they're really trying to drum up traffic in the afternoon and evening. And they're also trying to offer what they call that veto vote. So if there's a group of people trying to decide where to go for lunch or dinner, and some people want pancakes and someone else doesn't want pancakes, they feel like offering a better quality burger might convince people to give IHOP a try.
And when you look at the name IHOP, the I is for international, which is kind of funny in itself because there's not a whole lot of internationalism to IHOP, right?
There's not. I mean, it's a predominantly U.S. chain. Very few of their overall restaurants are even outside of the U.S. And if you look at the menu, there aren't a lot of international pancake options. There's a Belgian pancake, and there's a Mexican pancake, and that's really about it. So I'm not really sure where the international comes in.
Mm-hmm. This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Julie Jargon. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. A father and son in Rhode Island are running against each other for the same office. 47-year-old David Quiroa Sr. and 22-year-old David Quiroa Jr. have both filed to run for a state House seat currently held by a Democrat. Both live at the same address in Newport. The elder Quiroa is running as a Republican, the son as an independent. The Associated Press says the father and son frequently talk about politics and have since the son was little. When 2016 rolled around, the son was finally old enough to vote for president. His candidate was Hillary Clinton. His father became an early and avid supporter of Donald Trump. When the son heard his father was considering running for the seat, currently held by Democratic State Representative Marvin Abney, he says he began thinking how important it is for young people to get involved in politics. His father didn't take him seriously at first, but when the time came to drive to City Hall to file papers, they went together. Sounds like a lesson in civility. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.